U.S. stocks, if you take a look, they took a leg lower as Janet Yellen began speaking during the news conference, but they then recovered and closed off their lows. The Dow eking out a gain up by a quarter of 1%, closing at a record high. The S&P 500 losing 2.5 points. The Nasdaq here, the underperformer, losing 0.4%.
Yeah, we had been higher earlier in the day, obviously, but in the end, you know, the sort of headline indices not reacting with too much volatility to the Fed today.
A member of Uber's board of directors resigned after he made a sexist joke. The punchline? He did so at a staff meeting about how the ride-hailing service could rid its culture of sexual harassment and discrimination. David Bonderman on Tuesday saying he'd stepped down from the board because of a comment widely seen as offensive to women. It came after fellow board member Arianna Huffington spoke to staff about the importance of adding more women to the board of directors.
What is the view in Ireland? What is the view in the business community? What is the view inside Ryanair about how the situation changed, if at all, last week?
It's changed, and it's changed quite quickly. I think in the course of a week, we've gone from it being a hard Brexit, focusing on immigration, to what now the narrative being this is going to be a softer Brexit with a focus more about the economy. That's a good thing. A soft Brexit, people in Ireland, people in business would support. I think it's clear that the people in the UK, nearly a year after the referendum, now clearly prefer a soft Brexit than a hard Brexit. That's clearly the result.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Thursday. It's June 15th, 2017. 5:11 in the morning. Glad to have you here for another edition of Opening Bell, The Opening Bell. I wish I had better news for you on the markets this morning. They'll continue apparently going downward in the downward direction. We're looking for a weak open on Wall Street this morning. Markets all around the world seem to be lower today in the wake of the Federal Reserve decision yesterday. After more political turmoil in Washington, news from the Washington Post reporting that President Trump may be under investigation, is likely under investigation for obstruction of justice, not for anything he did with Russian meddling, but for apparently the alleged cover-up, or at least the obstruction into the investigation. Stock futures on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning reacting negatively off 91 points. The S&P and NASDAQ futures are lower as well. S&P futures off about 16. NASDAQ futures off almost a full percent. The slide with tech stocks apparently going to continue today. The NASDAQ off about 64 points. Around the world, Asian markets fell after the Federal Reserve interest rate decision yesterday. Lower oil prices also taking a toll on energy-related shares across the region. Property developers led the decline in Hong Kong. On the big board from Asia this morning, the Nikkei off almost a quarter. The Asian Dow off almost a percent. The Hang Seng off more than a percent. Nearly a percent and a half, 310 points. In Europe this morning, most of the indices are lower as well. The FTSE, the DAX, the CAC off almost a full percent each. Back in this country, oil trading $44.67 a barrel, off about 6 cents, down about almost 0.2 of a percent there. 44.67 is the reading. Some news that we've been watching since you went to bed last night. Canceled and delayed flights are rising on the nation's leading airlines, and so are consumer complaints. That's according to new figures released by the U.S. Department of Transportation. The rate of canceled flights included nearly doubled, 1.6% in April compared to the same month last year. Delta Airlines accounted for nearly half of the cancellation. You'll recall it was crippled for days by one storm in Atlanta. About 78.5% of flights arrived within 14 minutes of schedule, down from 84.5% in April of 2016. Complaints up 70%, although a tiny fraction of the millions of travelers lodged a protest. April was the month in which passenger was dragged off of the United flight out at O'Hare Airport. Also this morning, news that a Wall Street executive has been arrested. A federal judge has tossed out evidence seized from the home and business of this executive in this case, saying the government was grossly negligent in its searches. The ruling late yesterday was a blow to the government's criminal case against the financier Benjamin Way, the executive arrested back in 2015 on conspiracy, wire fraud, and securities fraud charges. Prosecutors say Way made tens of millions of dollars by manipulating the stock prices of companies in which he gained a secret financial interest. The rate to yesterday, the interest rate decision came from Janet Yellen in Washington. Interest rates going up. Her report afterwards talking about how the economy is moving along strongly and that the Fed feels that they can continue making changes in monetary policy going forward. She hinted that more rate increases may be coming later this year. We'll talk about that now with our thought leader conversation this morning. Doug Myers is the Senior Vice President, Private Banking Regional Manager at Associated Bank. He's with us on Thursday. We every Thursday have a thought leader conversation. And good morning, Doug. Welcome back to the Opening Bell.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning.
Glad to see you as always. Here we are after the Federal Reserve decision, and life is still going.
We're still turning, despite probably a concerted effort to increase interest rates. I think that's going to be ongoing for a while, and it's going to, I think, affect people with their debt payments, but I think it's also going to be good for the economy in an overall sense of the word.
And good for the economy how? I mean, give us
in terms of growing the economy, in terms of stemming inflation that I think has always been a risk. And I think with the low interest rates, for example, in banking, it's been very hard to make profits just due to the squeezed margins that the banks have had because of low interest rates. And, you know, coming from a banker's point of view, you know, interest rates rising, not too much, but a little bit, I think, is a good overall for the industry.
Yeah. A lot of discussion around this rate hike about, you know, whether or not the pace of all of this activity is equal to what we've been seeing in economic reports, whether there'll be more this year. What is your thought about where we're headed?
Well, we certainly think, you know, June's going to have an interest rate hike. And last year we predicted four, and it only increased twice. So I think our feeling is in the next couple of years, there's going to be a couple a year going forward. I mean, if you think about it, interest rates for the past, you know, 8 to 10 years have been very, very low. In fact, the lowest in our nation's history. And I think we're probably due for it, as I said. And I think that if you look at the strength of the economy, I think it's continuing to pick up and strengthen. I think there's companies with large cash reserves that are looking to employ capital now, and I think there's an overall optimism a little bit in that field. So I think that increased interest rates are going to help the economy and continue to help it grow.
Part of this is bad news for consumers who have debt, who are maybe having those credit cards with high balances. But the good part of this is if we have a savings account, we finally might get some interest going on that.
Yeah, it's a tale of two cities. I mean, if you have debt, you know, they say the average consumer has about $17,000 in credit card debt, and that equates to about, you know, probably an average of $1,300 a month in debt payments just on your credit cards. And people have car loans and mortgage loans and student debt that's going to be impacted by increased interest rates. On the other hand, like you mentioned, if you're a saver and have savings accounts, you know, interest rates have been anemic for the past several years, you know, making 1.1% on your savings account. And this is going to be welcome relief to people who have those bank accounts and savings accounts.
Yeah, there's all through life, people say, well, save, save, save. But if you have an account where it's not gaining interest, it really doesn't do much for you.
It's hard to justify keeping it in savings. That's exactly right.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about something else that's been happening. And I have to tell you, I read these stories every day and I'm confused. The fiduciary rule, we heard they're still, you know, discussing whether or not the Dodd-Frank Act is going to be repealed, what's going to happen with that. But the fiduciary rule, as we have been discussing previously, took effect. It's now in place, but could still go away. Is that fair? Is that
I think there's thoughts that the Dodd-Frank rule will not go away. I think it's going to be amended in several ways, but I don't think that it's going to be removed altogether. The Department of Labor fiduciary rule is very significant in the 401k and the IRA sector. You know, suitability is a very important concept. And what that means is that as long as an investment meets a client's defined or objective, it was deemed appropriate. But that's not in effect anymore. Fiduciary is a much higher level of accountability than the suitability standard that was previously adhered to. And so I think in the retail brokerage sector, I think in the financial planning sector, this is going to be significant. It's already impacted the way we do business. I think all the banks and financial firms are changing the way they do business as a result of this.
There has been a discussion about this that, first of all, a lot of time and energy and money in a lot of cases have been put to getting ready for this.
Absolutely.
And banks like yours have said, I think, probably that this is something they would do anyway, right?
Even well, if it was removed or not. Well, I'm not so sure of that, to be honest with you. I mean, this affects IRAs. It affects IRA rollovers, 401Ks. It affects defined benefit plans, and it affects annuities, which is a very big business in the financial sector. And some of the things we're doing to adhere to the new DOL ruling that took effect June 9th, is that we deployed new technology to help us satisfy this fiduciary standard. We've evaluated and changed our compensation structure to our brokers. We've streamlined and changed some products and actually removed some products from our bank. And lastly, we've had substantial training to train our financial counselors and brokers how to be fiduciary advisors now instead of just making, so to speak, making a commission on a sale. It's really changing the way we do business.
Let's talk a little bit about the Dodd-Frank Act, too, because you say that you don't think that will go away completely. It'll probably be changed. One side of the fence says, well, these are the rules that were put in place to prevent another economic crisis. Another says, well, you're keeping small to mid-sized banks down. Where's the middle ground here? What is the reason for this?
Well, I think there's once again, a tale of two cities in the banking world on as it relates to Dodd-Frank. You have the big banks, 50 billion plus, that are subjected to a lot of ornery rules in terms of capital, in terms of lending, in terms of liquidity, that has stifled some of the larger banks and more prevalent, the smaller banks. And so I think in some of these changes, they're looking to address some of the rules and regulations that will ease the regs and the restrictions on some of the smaller banks. So you've got the bigger banks were subjected to different rules than the smaller banks. But, you know, the banks are regulated in tranches of under $10 billion, between $10 billion and $50 billion, and then over $50 billion. And I think your point is well taken in that the larger banks over $50 billion, they have enacted rules, the too big to fail, so to speak. And I think that has helped the industry. But I think the margins and the profitability has really been squeezed due to overregulation in the smaller bank sector under $10 billion. And that's the sector that they're really trying to address and ease up a little bit.
How significant is the danger, though, of rolling back too many of these regulations?
Well, I think there's significant danger. And I think when you look at things like, you know, relaxed lending and relaxed maybe easing of capital requirements and easing of leverage requirements, I think in smaller banks, it makes a lot of sense. In some of the bigger banks, it probably doesn't. And I think that's what Congress is looking at revamping.
Has the banking industry learned its lesson from 2008? Are all those memories still in your mind and in the minds of your colleagues?
Yeah, that's a great question. We always say bankers have short memories. And, you know, when the economy gets frothy and real estate lending gets very aggressive, in opportunities that in a frothy economy, I think that you do have to have regulations and restrictions, and I think that you know, once again, we don't want the banks to be too big to fail like we had in the downturn back in 2008 and 2009.
The people who are sitting at the table discussing some of this, some of the biggest names in banking, you have Jamie Dimon and other folks. He sits on the president's council on this. Are there enough voices in there to keep everybody sort of sane and happy?
I think there's a creative tension between, so to speak, between the banking community and Congress. I think you've got very vocal opponents of banking, like, for example, Elizabeth Warren in Congress and in the Senate, who makes very good points, but at the same time, it's an interesting discussion going on. You know, Jamie Dimon has certainly emerged as one of the top voices in banking, and you look at at Goldman and Citigroup and some of the bigger banks, they're very vocal about what they need to do to stay in business and to make profits as well.
Where do you think this is all going to wash out? We saw the House pass, I think it was the House last week, pass their bill, and it's now going to be, I guess, melded with something in the Senate. Where do you think it's going to wash out?
I think it's all about compromise. I think, you know, when times are tough, you have the pendulum swinging to the left and to the right, and I think the common ground is in the middle.
And do you think that there is enough will to get this done sooner than later? We see a lot of things piling up on the doorsteps of Congress.
I think there's enough momentum to regulate some easing on some of the banking issues.
How is all this translating locally? You mentioned the housing market. Lots of real estate deals being done. Are you still seeing a heated up market?
It's certainly more heated than we saw 10 years ago in the downturn, and I think it's been a slow recovery, but I think we're seeing increased margins as interest rates increased. I think our bank is seeing more lending opportunities. We see a great improvement in the business climate in the Midwest. I know in the Texas, it's a very good economic environment compared to the Midwest. But yeah, we are seeing growth and we are seeing a lot of increased profits in the banking sector.
I heard one small business group say, I think it was earlier this week, that there was a time when small businesses couldn't go to banks and get loans, and that's changed now. That's the money's flowing, and you have all of these small business owners making plans for the next couple of years.
Yes, and I think that I think that small business lending is growing. I think the banks want to lend money to qualified borrowers. I met with a borrower yesterday, and we're looking at an SBA loan. And I think the SBA is very aggressively trying to increase. You know, it helps the banks lend money to risky startup businesses without the risk with the government banking. And I think that's very important to the growth of the economy. Small business it really sets the pace for the growth, I think, in our economy.
You mentioned the SBA there. Is that still a really good resource for small businesses to go and find help?
Absolutely.
Anything else on your radar screen?
No, I think that, we're dealing a lot with the fiduciary ruling. We're doing a lot with lending. We're doing a lot with investment management these days. We think it's a great economy and a great opportunity for us to continue to grow.
Here it is, almost the 4th of July, too.
Yes, it is.
Have a good rest of the month, and we'll see you again next time.
Thank you, Steve.
Doug Myers is Senior Vice President, Private Banking Regional Manager at Associated Bank. Remember, you can hear our thought leader conversation every Thursday right here on 720 WGN on the opening bell. And you can listen to our past conversations at WGNradio.com on the opening bell page. Also follow Associated Bank at Associated Biz on Twitter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. It's 542. Glad to have you here for our Thursday edition of the opening bell. Yesterday, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates in her post-rate hike news conference. Janet Yellen said the words, "We appear to be close to full employment in the country." Are we really, though? I want to bring in Tanzina Vega. She's a CNN national reporter for race and inequality. Tanzina, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning, and thanks so much for having me.
Good having you here. I started off with Janet Yellen and full employment, because every time I hear the phrase full employment, I cringe, because it's not really the case in many communities in America. And I bet you've been covering a lot of this, too, especially in communities that are minorities.
Correct. And I think when we think about full employment, we also have to think about it's not just the fact that people are employed; it's also who's making what.
Yeah, and in those, like, what is the job that people have? Right? Is that what you mean?
Right, the job and also pay. I mean, when we look at pay across, as you mentioned, my beat is race and inequality. So when we look at pay rates across race in America, we see there's been research done specifically by the Economic Policy Institute that shows that even when controlled for experience and education, blacks are still paid less than whites are. So, you could say, I've gone to college, I've got this many years of experience, I have the job, you know, I'm working. And even still, on average, you're less likely to be paid what your white colleagues are. So we need to factor that into when we think about, you know, who's working and how we're working.
And I bet you get to see this from a national perspective, too. Where in the country is it worse? Where is it better or getting better?
Well, the truth is that you know, nationally speaking, we have a wealth issue in America. And so I think a lot of times we tend to focus on these independent markers. So, you know, what the employment rate is, what the income rates are. But when we look broadly across the country, according to the Survey of Consumer Finances, white Americans on average have 13 times the net wealth that Black Americans have. And let's put that in dollar form. That means for every $13 a white family has on average of wealth, we're not talking about income, Black families have $1. Okay, so that's where we are nationally. Like, obviously, there are different pockets across the country, but in no metro area have we seen Blacks make more money than whites on average. And that data comes from the National Urban League State of Black America.
Is the feeling among the communities, is it one of frustration or is it worse than that?
Oh, absolutely. There's absolutely frustration. I think when we think about inequality in America, oftentimes we think about the images that we know, right? So school segregation, police shootings, the things that make it into the news. And these are obviously critical parts of equality. But we don't tend to think about the economic elements of social inequity, right? These issues have major consequences. This racial wealth gap that we're talking about didn't just happen overnight. This has happened, you know, since the founding of this country. And so we are seeing an exacerbated rate of wealth inequality right now. And that has an impact on who's able to afford, to go to school, who's able to afford to buy a home, the value of certain homes, who's able to access credit, who's able to get credit either for a home or to start their own business. So this has serious implications beyond, you know, just being annoyed that you might or frustrated by the fact that you're not making the same amount as your colleagues. I mean, these are issues that are structural and institutional.
And are these concerns and frustrations, are they going in the opposite direction now that the Trump administration is in place?
Well, I think we need to. This is a wait and see situation where obviously there's a lot of information coming out of the administration on a day to day basis. So we're absolutely trying to track that. I don't, you know, we need to really think about what's going to change this. And oftentimes we see, you know, there are some solutions touted which, you know, talk about tax credits and those are important. There have been baby bonds suggested for communities of color. We've even gone so far as to talk about reparations, specifically for Black Americans. But economic justice is something that has to be considered, and it has to be looked at, you know, in terms of how we're continuing to dismantle, if you will, a lot of the structural inequities. Because even, like I said, when you look at the data, when you control for all of the other variables, you know, race plays a major role in our economics. And that's something that has to be factored into policy. And we're going to see if it is.
And gender, too. We've had a stark example this week again of this with the Uber boardroom behind closed doors. You've seen that story. Women
Correct.
And women of color especially. I mean, the fact that a board member or a shareholder at one of the biggest companies in the country can talk like that in front of everybody and basically say,
yeah,
we don't need any more women because all they do is talk in these meetings. I mean, that's just stunning to me.
Well, we've seen that also in our Kamala Harris example
right.
this week as well. There was a lot of, I actually tweeted about that. I said, you know, women of color know what it feels like, what Kamala Harris is feeling after she was quieted, you know, asked to be quiet for the second time in a second hearing when no other folks were asked to do the same. And so I asked people, I said, you know, raise your hand if you've been, you know, shushed, scolded, or silenced. It's probably the most popular tweet I've ever done. We're up now at about 5,500, you know, likes and hundreds of women, even white women, who are saying, you know, I have friends who have experienced this. So this is something that happens, and this is really, you know, you can call it unconscious bias. These are things, biases that we harbor inside that we may not be aware of. But I think there's also, you know, a change in how we look at this. And women of color, you mentioned in terms of pay, we're paid even less than our male counterparts. So when you control for gender, when you add gender to the mix, there are, you know, Black and Latina women in particular are paid much less. And that has implications. Often we are, you know, if you're the head of household, it lessens your buying power. It lessens the ability for you to actually, you know, contribute to the economy. So, you know, we're dealing with a lot of these issues. And this is something I'm actually trying to address for women of color, specifically in my upcoming book that I'm reporting now about the inequalities that women of color specifically face in the United States.
We always talk about these being learning moments, and I don't know if that's getting old, if that term's getting old, but here we are having the conversation about it. I'm sure others are as well, but more needs to be done, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and I think where the frustration is happening is a lot of people are saying, look, we've talked about this. We cannot, this is something that can't, there's almost an interesting and very persistent willfulness for Americans to not want to talk about race in a way that's constructive. And I think that, you know, there are parts of our history that are fantastic, and there are parts of our history that are really, really difficult for us to grapple with. And I think it's going to require Americans of all races, particularly white Americans, to sit down and say, look, even if, you know, I often hear people say, well, my grandparents or great-grandparents didn't, you know, have slaves, for example, and we weren't a part of that. But what is missing from that conversation is the fact that, you know, whites still benefit from it. There was one report put out by Demos about the racial wealth gap, which is a think tank here in New York, and they called it the asset value of whiteness. Whiteness inherently has value. And if we do not, you know, look at the way that whites have benefited structurally from, you know, housing policies, which one researcher recently called, you know, structural and socially sanctioned segregation. I mean, this, you know, everything from accessing credit to home values to school, segregated schools, to the ability to get to work, transportation, all of these things combined have created this wealth gap. And whites in America really have to, you know, enter the conversation in a way that I think they've been resisting for quite some time.
Your upcoming book is called Uppity Women, Race, and Class in America. When will we see that?
We'll see that. Give me about a year. We're still in heavy reporting mode, but the goal is to take the issues that impact women of color, including Latinas, African-American women, Asian women, and Native American women, and talk about these issues from a data perspective and also from personal anecdotes. So stay tuned.
Well, when it's out, we'd love to have you back.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Tanzina Vega is a CNN national reporter on race and inequality, also a Ferris professor at Princeton. The book is Uppity Women, Race, and Class in America, coming out next year.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, Dow futures off almost 92 points now. NASDAQ futures off 70, down a full percent. Now S&P futures lower as well. The latest on commodities and agriculture. Good morning to Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, it had to come to an end sometime, and it sure did yesterday in the cattle market at the Mercantile Exchange. Live cattle nearby contracts finishing down the $3 per hundredweight daily price limit, fund liquidation, and lower cash prices along with that. The June and the August contracts closed down limit at $124.50 and $117.87. Cash cattle, well, so far this week, they've been bid about $7 below prices of a week ago. So a red close for live cattle and feeder cattle. In the hog market, a little different. Cash prices were higher, and wholesale pork prices moved up a little bit, so they finished the day higher in the two nearbys. Grain and soybean futures mostly lower yesterday. Minneapolis spring wheat declining from an earlier 2.5-year high on pressure from technical selling and forecast for crop-friendly rainfall. Showers moving through spring wheat growing areas in the northern U.S. plains and the Canadian prairies. And so the nearby wheat contract down 1.75, and nearby corn down 4.25, and nearby soybeans down just 0.75 cents. Well, President Trump, who visited Wisconsin earlier this week, made one comment on the milk war between Canada and the United States. He said Tuesday he was making progress on behalf of Wisconsin dairy farmers in a dispute with Canada over its trade practices. He said, "We are making big progress on opening things up." That's your money. Have a great day. Now, I'm Orion Samuelson.
Now, the Associated WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for this Thursday, June 15th. Labor Department reports today on the number of people who applied for unemployment benefits. The National Association of Home Builders in Wells Fargo releases its June index of builder sentiment. Freddie Mac reports on this week's average U.S. mortgage rates. There are two reports from the Federal Reserve out today. The Fed reports on U.S. industrial production for May. The Federal Reserve also has its June survey of manufacturers in New York. Treasury Department releases international money flows data for April.